This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with today's interview. I got the chance to talk to John Carney, the director of Flora and Son. It will be in theaters on September 22nd, and then it will be on Apple TV Plus a week after that on September 29th. It premiered earlier this year at the Sundance Film Festival. It was also in Toronto last week. So John's really been on the road talking to people about this movie, which is an interesting pseudo-pandemic era story about a mother in Dublin, played by Eve Hewson, who winds up taking guitar lessons via Zoom and sparking a sort of romance with a guitar teacher played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. But as we got into this movie and kind of talked to John about how all the pieces fell into place, he got the idea for the Zoom lessons, not from the pandemic, but it was really only the pandemic that made him feel like people would believe the concept of falling in love via Zoom, which is something we're now all too familiar with. But the movie really started as a tribute to his mother. He kind of talks about himself as being a little bit of a hell-raising teenager, kind of like the son of the title that Eve Hewson's character Flora has. His name is Max. And how he kind of found himself via music. And the flight of fancy this movie takes is that Flora, the mother, also finds herself via music. I'm a real sucker for a mother and son story, which I was happy to tell him as well. And when he made Sing Street back in 2016, he talked about that maybe being his last musical. And Flora and Son isn't really a musical, but he has this kind of abiding belief in music's ability to transform people and build relationships. And that's really present in Flora and Son in a lovely way that you might recognize from his films like Sing Street and Once especially, and also Begin Again. I love this movie and I love getting to talk to John Carney about how it came together. So let's hear my conversation with Flora and Son writer and director John Carney. You're freshly back from Toronto, I think, where Flora and Son was playing, which I guess was probably pretty different from Sundance because you were there with your whole cast. How does being the sole ambassador for a movie with everyone on strike, how does that feel for you? Is it a strange role?
I'm surprised that I've risen to the occasion without having a nervous breakdown. It's been a huge amount of work, and we've sung, you know, we played songs to try and make up for the fact that there was, you know, wasn't as much of an event without the actors there. We've been on the road, we've been doing rolling press and all of that, but I love this film and this story is personal to me. And so I'm happy to talk about it, and I think that's the main thing. Because, you know, I've had a mother and I've been a musician, and I've been a delinquent teenager for a couple of years who was saved by music to a degree and my friends and the people that I was lucky enough to meet. So it's personal to me, so I can talk about it. So it's been easier than I expected without the cast.
Good. When you were doing press for Sing Street, I think, I don't know if you said this in exact words, but something that like it might have been your last musical and kind of thinking of it a triptych of the films you'd made before. And I don't think Flora and Son is a musical by any standard, but it does seem like music kind of like pulled you back when you thought you were out. How was that process actually for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I believe in life. So I keep on banging on about it. And there's a little audience for it, which is great. So as long as that is happening, I still will try and explore musical themes. And as you're right, they're not musicals. They are musically themed stories, you know, often about people who for whom music kind of makes up for something missing in their life and sort of stops a gap. So, yeah, so I you know, I'm a firm believer in that. It's happened to me numerous times in my life that music has bridged something that I've needed and allowed me to cross over to something that I feel like I've needed, or someone, or and I think Flora is a case in point. You know, it's a movie about somebody who discovers that music doesn't just come from like a DJ putting down a needle drop or a, but that it actually has an organic starting point, which is an instrument, which is usually made of, you know, wood and steel and wire and pegs and mother of pearl and all these elements from the earth, you know, to produce another amazing thing, which is the actual resonance of the notes. Like, it's an amazing thing in life to learn that. It's an amazing gift to get music.
You've said that you know, the character of Flora really comes from your mother in some ways, that you were, you know, this is a tribute to her. Was that the starting point for this film entirely, that you were thinking of your mom? Did it start with the character of Flora? Did it start with the idea of a mother and son? Like, what was the seed of the whole thing?
No, that was the backdrop. Hmm. It was a thing that I was walking around thinking about was my mother and our relationship. I wasn't saying to myself, oh, you know, this is my next movie I want to make about my, you know, a relationship between a son and a mother. And then I found this amp in a skip, and I brought it home and fixed it up and, you know, managed to sort of make music out of something that was somebody else's trash.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's an interesting story.
Yeah.
And I traded it out for a guitar rather than an amplifier. And then I thought that a woman pulling a guitar out of the trash was more interesting than a guy.
Hmm.
I don't know why. It just told me, you know, a guy pulling stuff out of rubbish is kind of what we do. A woman getting up there and climbing up and dirtying her trousers in her hands to pull this thing out. She's like a very interesting looking character. And you kind of know, you know, you're kind of very interested to see where she goes home with that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the image. And then the son came second. And then I came back to what I'd been thinking about my mother and sort of joined the two things.
And then where were we in the pandemic when the idea of Zoom guitar lessons comes up? I'm just assuming this is a pandemic-born thing. Maybe not. But it felt very familiar.
Yeah. No, it was before the pandemic that I came up with the central sort of conceit.
Yeah.
And I then paused the movie with her opening the laptop and meeting Jeff because it didn't make sense.
Hmm.
That two people could fall in love or deepen their relationship through Skype or something like that. And then the pandemic hit and I reopened the script and it suddenly kind of had permission for me to go on to write it. Because I had paused it and I didn't know, I felt like I was at a cliff edge with that. I didn't think people would relate to people speaking on screen. Who knew what was just around the corner.
Yeah.
But when that happened, then we got used to that, then I returned to the script.
Did you have that moment that so many creative people I've talked to had when the pandemic starts, where it's like, are we ever going to go see movies again? Is anyone going to go sit in a theater again? It felt like many people got really frozen by this enormous upheaval, but it almost sounds like to you, like there was inspiration in it fairly quickly.
No, it wasn't actually. That wasn't how I felt. I was gloomy and depressed during the pandemic, and I didn't feel like I'm just carrying on. And actually, wow, I wrote the script as a therapy thing during COVID, and it was actually good to write something about two characters that weren't in the room together. It was kind of good therapy for me.
Yeah,
it makes you know what I mean.
Makes you feel like it's possible again when we all had the Zoom fatigue.
Yeah, but I do think we're still struggling mm-hmm. after that with, you know, it's really changed people.
Yeah.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Yeah, I mean, you've been out on the road with this movie talking to people. You know, I was just in Toronto and I felt like the audiences were in some ways even more enthusiastic than they were before COVID. But there's also a lot of ways where people don't know how to behave anymore. I'm curious what you've noticed being out in the world with this movie, maybe more so than 7 years ago.
I think it's totally changed. I think that the way business is done and socializing is done, and a festival is actually a very good example because it's a bit of both. It's a mix of people coming together, but it is altered.
Yeah.
It has changed. And I think the internet was already changing it in a way, and then the pandemic sort of fast-tracked all of that into this strange, strange world where we're like two versions of ourselves a little bit now.
Yeah. Well, the way that Flora and Son works with the internet is really interesting because obviously you've got this very rich connection between them via these guitar lessons. But then you've got the kids in the neighborhood who are filming, you know, music videos on the roof of a car. Mm-hmm. I guess it's for TikTok. I don't understand enough of TikTok to even know if that's what you meant, but it seemed like it. And
no, they were just making a video. I didn't think where it was going.
Sure. But yeah. It's similar, you know, they're making it to post online to kind of present themselves to the world.
Probably.
And
I think
your movies are very not judgmental of characters, but there is kind of this bafflement that you see in Flora there. And I wonder how much that comes directly from you about music, something that you love so much, and about that being a way that young people are interacting with it that maybe we don't fully understand. At least I don't fully understand.
Yeah, the technology changes the art form, and it always has. You know, the inventions and they have to have an effect on the way we produce work and art. And you know, the constant sharing that everybody is doing now and posting and showing off is affecting what's being made.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, probably in quite a negative way, but I just think it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get Taylor Swift gigs who, you know, there's more people at than there were ever at.
Yeah.
So she's cracked the code. She's figured something out. But I don't know if the kind of 1,000-seater or 500-seat venues, like if you take, you know, years ago, you could be somebody like Leonard Cohen or somebody like that and be making tons of money filling these venues, you know.
Yeah.
But you were huge. You were a huge star. Nowadays, there are those things are happening and people are making a living, but we don't know who they are now.
Yeah.
You just know the big three, and then everybody else is like a bottom-feeding, scrappy person on Twitter trying to promote herself or himself, themselves, and then there's nowhere in between.
Yeah. So for you, it's less about the style of music as it changes and more about the way that people are able to get audiences and express themselves. That's kind of dire.
Yeah, I would have thought that, like, you know, my advice anyway to young filmmakers when they ask me what it is, it's like, well, whatever I learned is probably not that helpful to you because it was learned at a different time. I would be liberated to explore not just the movie themes, but the way that you're making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would be excited by that if I was 17 or 18 now and was like, I really am a film fan and I want to make films. I would probably start to think about cool ways and interesting, involving ways to show the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that would then affect the way you make. And I don't even know if they're movies.
Yeah. Do you watch stuff like that? Like, do you feel like it's part of your job to kind of keep up on the ways that that's changing, or is that
no.
up for the next generation?
I think I would if I was young, but I think I'm too lazy and old, and I have two children, so I don't get to do that.
They'll teach you eventually. It all comes back around. But the way that Max, the teenage character in this, the way that he's making music is different from what his mom does. Like, it seems like you're kind of extending a hand to saying, like, look, you're not every kid's going to pick up a guitar to learn how to make music. He's going to have a laptop and a synthesizer, but it all kind of gets them to the same place, right?
Exactly, yeah. Because I think in the end of the day, it's about harmonizing and mixing instruments together to make some new sound out of it.
Yeah.
whether or not you share it or whether or not. I mean, what I like about Flora or the movie is that they never, they do use the internet and computers to create things and to obviously they're using broadband to connect. But the thing that they produce ends up being live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like that. They don't, it's not about going and getting Twitter followers or Instagram followers mm-hmm. or getting numbers. It's about having a fucking gig in a pub with your mates.
And you end, I mean, not to spoil the entire movie, but the way that the movie ends with an emphasis on the people watching them, not them. Like, it's about the effect they're having on the people immediately in front of them.
That's a cool way of looking at it.
That's what it made me think of. Just like, it's about the world around them, not just our characters we've been following.
Yeah.
Talking about styles of music, I was so struck by early in the conversations between Flora and Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Jeff, where she mentions that she loves James Blunt's song, and he's so dismissive and such a classic, like, rockist guy.
Yeah.
And she kind of brushes him off, but I don't know if the movie ever comes back around for him to, like, learn the error of his ways. Like, do you have sympathy for his point of view where he thinks that song is garbage, or does he need to learn to be less pretentious? Like, I couldn't decide where you landed on it.
I'm glad you couldn't, because what I've realized is my movies are generally sort of tempered versions of things that I want to say.
Hmm.
But I make an edit before they become me, because I am quite insufferable and sanctimonious about certain things. And my wife is like, oh, shut up. And so I basically try to make the edit before you want to say, oh, shut up. You know, but Flora does come back to him and she does say, like, is it okay if I like the James Blunt thing? And then he bats it back. It's kind of like a game of tennis. Like, nobody, it's not about winning.
Yeah.
You know, he then says, no, I'm going to de-brainwash you. And that does sound like mansplaining. But actually, if somebody said that to me, I'd go, oh, fuck you. But I would also be kind of grateful for it as well, because mm-hmm. we need de-brainwashing.
On both sides, right? Like, you have to be taken off. Some of us have to be taken off our high horse, and some of us have to, you know, learn to see, you know, more highfalutin things than you meet in the middle, like the song goes, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. No, but I like sanctimonious people that are up on their horse a little bit. The more I see of the world, I'm like, I've got something to learn. They may be a bit insufferable.
Hmm.
And I don't know if I'd invite them to every dinner party, but I'm kind of grateful for expertise.
That's a good point.
And sometimes, you know, in like academia or in, it can be a little bit like, Jesus, you know, a little bit dusty and a little bit opinionated. But it's good to have that in the world as well. And I enjoy the people that I know that are very strident about, you know, don't listen to this, but do listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know... I listen to those people because they're often as hard on themselves as they are on you or on the artist that they're talking about. But yeah, you don't want to make a movie about somebody. And a lot of producers have read my stuff and said, I really liked her speech on page 5, but can we cut it before she gets annoying?
And you don't try not to take it personally about them, maybe they're calling you annoying?
I don't really mind being annoying.
As long as your characters aren't.
Exactly. Yeah.
That seems like a good way to live.
Yeah.
Well, Flora is kind of, she's strident in a different way, right? Like she's very opinionated, not about art, but about the way that she's lived her life. She's like, you know, kind of brashly moving forward things. And her lack of interest in subtext was so striking to me, where every, you know, the minute that she has this first Zoom call, she like immediately takes it way too far. You know, comparing to something like Once, where it's entirely about subtext, like she's kind of committed to just like cutting through it with a machete at every single moment. And I wonder what drew you to that specific aspect of that character, who can just cut down all of this atmosphere and tension that you as a filmmaker are working so hard to build, and she sees right through it.
Yeah, it's interesting. She does do that. She's like a cynic, sort of sitting on the edges. And anytime it gets near something sincere, she kind of blows it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do that a little bit.
Hmm.
But I think we're kind of living in a time, aren't we now, of like, we've had 100 years of cinema and, you know, 60 or 70 years of TV, and it's all been collated and organized now.
Hmm.
And the votes are in, and there's a very recent interesting backlash against the conventional tropes of movie making.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of that is women making films and hearing stories from all around the world, from South Korea and Argentina, you know, not just needing American movies or British pop music or whatever, you know, or whatever, that the tropes, the familiar conventions of, like, you know, the way when you see an 80s or a 90s movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can, in a South Park way, you can, like, deconstruct it in a really funny way because you can see everything coming.
Uh-huh.
And that was fine for years because it's satisfying. But recently, I think, you know, there's so many great filmmakers and TV writers and who are so smart that like, and Poker Face, that TV show, which I'm just happened to be watching, is constantly doing that.
Yeah.
Is like, I know you expect this and it should happen, but I'm saying the exact opposite. And I love that.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm doing anything more original than that. I think everybody is kind of doing that at the moment. It's a great line in Poker Face I was listening to last night, which is like, somebody's giving her a warning and they're saying, there's three things you need to know. You know, there's three rules about such and such. The first two you don't need to know. The third one, and it's really, because rather than just saying there's one thing you need to know, it's just such a, and you expect it to go one, two, three,
yeah.
in the way that you've heard that, you know, so many times in movies, three things. One, blah, blah, blah. Two, blah, blah, blah. Three, that.
Yeah.
And just that kind of very smart kind of writing that goes, actually, wouldn't it be funnier if you just eliminated the first two?
Yeah.
But plot, that's happening, like, to subtle dialogue, but it's also happening to, like, plot and character development and storytelling. And I think that Flora is, it does that. And at any moments where there's, like, you know, they seem to be coming together in a movie way, she's like, are you coming on to me?
Uh-huh, exactly.
And she just gets it wrong.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of fun to watch. And also, it's kind of like, I love people who do that. I know a lot of Dubliners that do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun.
Yeah. Well, how does that affect you in the way that you write a story, knowing the impulse to tear things down? Because when you're doing a romance, it's either they get together or they don't get together. Or maybe in the future, you know, there's only so many outcomes when you have it between two people. So does that make you think like, oh, I need to zag here? Like, how do you work that into how you write?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm a bit tired of the boy meets girl, they sing songs thing. And I'm partly I've done that. But I've always tried to find unique ways of doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like in Keira Knightley cycling off on her own at the end of, you know, between James Corden and Mark Ruffalo, or Adam Levine and Mark Ruffalo. I've just realized what an incredibly champagne problem those two men present to her. she kind of goes off on her own at the end. You know, in any other movie or any other time, she would run to back to Ruffalo or something like that.
Yeah.
And that would have been satisfying then.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that actually it is that satisfying, her going off on her own, because in the end of the day, we don't want to be on our own.
Mm-hmm.
But
except
we're going
maybe
through.
Sometimes we need to be, you know, and it feels in some ways like Flora too.
Yeah, or the storytelling needs to reinforce the idea that before you are with somebody, you need to know how to be on your own.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to, you know, Shirley MacLaine running back to Jack Lemmon from Fred McMurray in The Office, who's a heel. She runs to the mensch, and mm-hmm. then her life is complete, and yeah. she won't commit suicide again. It's very satisfying for 1960 or 59, whenever that movie was made, but for 2023, we're going through an era of redressing all that inequality for women mm-hmm. and all that weird judgment about how women should be. And that's a very necessary process to go through cinematically to make sure that that's true. But then the funny thing is, at the end of the day, you know, like, Billie Eilish can say, like, what am I made for?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really good question.
Mm-hmm.
But it's depressing. And in a way, you yeah. know, what you could say at the end of it is, the only thing you're made for is love.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Whether it's yeah. a love for your kid or a person, but we don't want to be on our own. We have to go through the fire, but actually we want to connect.
Yeah.
And I think my movies are about that.
I was just trying to think, you know, I feel like the end of Flora and Son does a really good job of establishing that while also upending the whole boy meets girl idea. I think Once does that. I think Sing Street, even though I was reading where you suggested maybe Sing Street should have ended with them dying in the ocean, which really would have been a different version
yeah,
of this.
That's the South Park version.
Exactly. yeah. But Flora and Son, it's like a bait and switch that's not there, where you've got the title. And then for so much of the movie, you're watching this relationship develop on screen. And then as the movie continues, you're like, no, this movie's called Flora and Son. That's what it's actually about. And it kind of lulls you into almost seeing past what the actual thing is, which is, it's, you know, it's such a fascinating reminder of what that actual love that you're trying to talk about is.
Mm-hmm. And it's fun to play with that and to go, no, you can't go off with the love story right now. And you shouldn't, you know, it's got to be anchored back to the title of the movie.
Yeah.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz. Who should be the mayor of New York?
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I was thinking about how the girl in Once has a child, but it's kind of just like, it's a really young child, and it's like more of like a plot factor than a relationship. And this is such a specific relationship, and you yourself have kids who I assume aren't toddlers. And I have my oldest son is 7, but he's already getting to that point of life where like he has things he's interested in. And if I don't want to keep up, I got to go do it too. And that's a really interesting time for a parent where this kid who you have created kind of starts taking you by the hand and taking you somewhere you don't expect. And I wonder if that aspect of that relationship between Flora and Max came from you personally about, you know, watching your kids change you with what they care about.
Yeah, I think a little bit. I mean, it was more my relationship with my own mother and I was Max that I was looking at. But there definitely were areas where, because I have a 7-year-old as well, where I would, that would tally into them. Then I'd have to ask myself, or, you know, I'd be trying to write a scene about my mother and me and remember what that was like. And then my kid would run in the door and say, stop writing, let's do something.
Yeah.
And then I'd go, oh, that's interesting. Now I have to actually, now I'm being forced to actually confront the thing I'm writing about, which is, do I spend time with this kid or do I ignore him, go on writing?
Yeah.
And what's my relationship? You know, what is it like to be Flora and have a kid? Because I'm thinking of it as, what's it like being the kid to my mother?
Yeah.
And that, the big realization, well, not the big realization, but one of the things in the movie is, you know, when she sings at the end, we fucked this up so many times or whatever she's singing. We've tried it and we've always messed it up. Let's get it right for once. And she's like, and then she concludes that with saying like, I'm not living in your life. You're not living in mine.
Yeah.
And it sounds banal, but it's actually the key in a way to the movie, which is for her and for their relationship. But also for many parents, it's like, I shouldn't be trying to get into my kid's life all the time. But at the same time, having a kid isn't just waiting for them to become an adult. You know, waiting for the kid to get into my life so we can go to the cinema together or talk. It's a joy. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a compromise of like, let's meet in the middle. Like, let's find the game that we can play together.
Totally.
That doesn't completely bore me as an adult, but also that you can figure out. And, you know, I can think of the amount of times I've tried to jump ahead in the trajectory with my son where he wasn't ready for American in Paris or Tom Waits music. and then, like, all of a sudden he does get something and you're like, oh, I tried that 2 years ago and it was too early because I was too eager to get him past his beautiful childhood, which actually I shouldn't be eager to do, but I also shouldn't want, and you know, and no more than should I be getting up all in his stuff and validating everything that he's doing.
Yeah.
And you know, so when he plays me a shitty song from a terrible Hollywood film or Netflix movie, I'm like, that's not a very good song.
That takes courage. That's a hard thing.
Or I
to
play
do.
Him something. I don't actually say that because I don't want to dump on his stuff, but I play him something better and hope that he'll see.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, you know, but I do think we're getting into a very strange world of crossover between kids and adults where kids are very keen to like get validation from adults.
That's interesting.
And they shouldn't. They actually shouldn't, because they won't create new work and new art if they're looking for validation from old people like me.
Yeah. But aren't the old, I mean, you know, I don't think either of us is holding the keys to a Hollywood studio, but don't you have to on some level appeal to what people 30 years older than you want to make art that can be seen?
Not in the art that I grew up in. No, I don't believe so at all, actually. I think that homogenizes everything.
Yeah, it definitely
does. It makes
everything
very polite and very respectful and very, you can't take a risk if you're trying to appeal to your mum.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want my parents coming to my gigs when I was in a band.
Did they come?
And in fact, my father came to a school gig that I did when I was about 15 or 16, and it was awkward.
Yeah.
And I didn't like him there. And then I was in a band sort of professionally, if you will, from sort of when I left high school, and my parents never came. And it would have been weird them coming down. It would have been weird them coming to a rock concert. And I, because it's different from sports. Like, you want like your parents to show up at your sports game, but there's a privacy that kids, that young adults need.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get up all in that as a parent.
Is the implication of Florence on then that they, you know, they have this moment, they come together through music, but that Max is going to get to continue to make his own thing that his mom has nothing to do with? Is that the hope?
Actually, yeah. I mean, it's a good question, because I'm probably selling a slightly different thing with the movie, which is like, get with your mom and play and figure it out. But I mean, that's a dysfunctional relationship. But I actually, you know, we're getting off the subject a little bit, but I think that my generation did not want to appeal to their parents' generation. They didn't want to watch the same movies as their parents, and they didn't want to. So when my kids ask me to watch Pixar cartoons, I'll do it, but I don't think they're good movies for adults. They're not good movies for adults, because they're cartoons, they're drawings, they're for children. And I don't the fact that they've got some clever jokes in them or some adult voices that I know, it's not for me. I'm an adult. I need Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton drinking and rowing.
Well, yeah, when your kids get older, then you can watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf together, and then you then maybe never watch a movie together again if you watch that one with your kids.
Yeah, exactly.
That might be the way to end it there.
Yeah.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back later this week. Find us in the meantime on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider. We're all at vanityfair.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors, as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.